morning, diners and travelers. Thank you for joining us and On the Menu with Ann and Peter Haig. Today's program is going to be a very, very good one.
Okay, and because if you asked people to name their favorite restaurant cities in the United States, undoubtedly they would probably start at the top with New York. They'd place San Francisco second. There'd be arguments about third or fourth, perhaps between Chicago and where else?
Did you say New Orleans?
But coming New Orleans, but coming out of left field and rising with great rapidity is the fine historical city of Charleston, South Carolina. And we go there frequently, and today we have interviews with four of the reasons why Charleston is getting the name that it has. And several of them will be new to you. So be prepared for some pleasant surprises and some really nice young men and middle-aged men too, I guess. But we're starting out with a chef who has made a mark already at age 31 or 32 for a wonderful restaurant called McGrady's, which is a particularly modern style.
I think he's 33.
but his new venture, Husk, is quite different, an entirely different concept and a remarkable story. So here's Sean Brock from McGrady's Restaurant and his sommelier, Clint Sloan.
Welcome to On the Menu, Clint Sloan, and I think maybe my favorite chef, Sean Brock. Pretty, don't tell any other chefs that. From Charleston, South Carolina, of two restaurants. One is the absolute dream restaurant called McGrady's that we just love. And then a second one that was just opened recently called Husk. And we've had talks and discussions about McGrady's before on the menu, but this is the first chance we've had to really talk to a chef about Husk. And then we're going to talk about the concept of that, and also then we're going to talk to Clint about his most unusual wine list. Let's start with, where did this idea come from, Sean, and how could you describe your idea of Husk?
Well, Husk really is a combination of many different ideas. First and foremost, the idea is that I've come to realize over the last 7 years cooking in this region and meeting the farmers, becoming their friends and the artisans and the fishermen, and realizing that we have the most incredible resources at our fingertips in the South. Just the most beautiful food, beautiful waters. And I wanted an opportunity to showcase that so that when someone from California or New York City or Canada, for that matter, came to visit the South in Charleston, they would have an opportunity to truly taste like sort of the current state of Southern food. So we made this rule. We're only allowed to buy food grown in the South. That way we create this discipline so that we don't have the temptation to buy things from elsewhere. We have to only cook ingredients grown and produced in the South.
And what does that eliminate?
It makes your pantry half the size it used to be, because you start realizing that you don't know anything about cooking, because you have to start making your own vinegar. You have to find sources for salt and sugar and all these things that you take for granted.
You mean salt is from South Charleston, South Carolina, or just the South?
The South. We want to showcase the South.
Okay, so where do you get salt?
We get it from a couple different places. The one that has the most salt to share with us is Avery Island, where they make Tabasco. There's a salt mine underneath there.
Oh, wow.
We get some really beautiful salt from the Keys. We're actually getting a beautiful fleur de sel style salt from
right,
there.
Right, so you're getting a salt, that's a salt pan based, right?
Yes.
So that's Mediterranean style salt pan salt.
And we're learning so much about food, and in turn, we're teaching people about food. So when you eat here, we want you to think about the work that goes into getting the food on the plate and the people responsible for that work.
Well, you yourself have a farm, and you're a producer, right?
We are. We are solely committed to saving at this point, resurrecting those heirloom plants at risk of extinction, southern crop, and that's a whole nother conversation.
Yeah, now you also have some pigs, though, right?
We are no longer raising pigs.
Oh, you're no longer raising pigs.
We aren't right now. We're a work project.
Okay.
We're working on a poultry project. We're working on a pig project. And hopefully it just never ends.
Now, we had a wonderful reception at your... And a couple of the absolutely wonderful featured things were your pickles and your charcuterie.
And what that is a preservation. And one thing that the South does quite well, and a restaurant like Hut's so important to preserve, because in the winter months when there's nothing growing, we can't just pick up the phone and call Chile and order asparagus. We have these rules, so we have to preserve things that have to go into mason jars.
I love your pickled green tomatoes. Took me back to my childhood. My mother made them.
We were pickling green tomatoes till 1:30 last night.
Oh, wow.
No kidding. Now, where did you get... So you are getting green tomatoes from somewhere in the South, even at this time of the year?
Yeah, most definitely. Georgia and Florida always stays ahead, and they always provide us with the emergency food that we need when we can't get it from here in Charleston. It's great.
Okay, so you can get a green tomato, but you can't get a red one at this particular season.
No, not yet. It'll be a little while. It'll be a couple months.
Now, what are some of the signature dishes that you have at Husk?
Well, the beauty of Husk is the menu changes in some form or fashion every single day. So we have a system where we end the night, we take a piece of paper, and we write down all of the ingredients that we have in the house, and then we sit down and write the menu. And then we just have a system where the food just sort of walks in the door. We really don't order much food here. We just sort of have these relationships with farmers and fishermen and artisans that if you got it, bring it. We'll buy it. We need it.
Okay, so that's a great idea. We've actually heard other people talk about stocking their larder the same way. And that
changes everything. That's a game changer. I mean, you have to change the way you cook and design dishes. It's great.
But you might have this walking in the door. But here now we have Clint, who is the sommelier of all of the restaurants, or both the restaurants. In fact, I think there's another one, too. But at any rate, how do you design a wine list to go with that kind of changing menu?
Well, this is the aha factor, right?
I think it's versatility. I think, we have the same amount of glass pours at Husk that we do at McCready's, although Husk is only 50 bottles and all the wines are under $100, whereas at McCready's you have 500 wines ranging from 36 to upwards. So I think working with Sean for over 5 years, even at McCready's the menu changes quite frequently. So as a sommelier you have to have all your guns and weapons prepared. So I think the more that you have available at pouring by the glass, I think that helps a lot.
But you had a major aha moment, and you did something that was so significant that Food and Wine magazine's current issue named you as one of the sommeliers of the year, which is quite an honor. And incidentally,
congratulations
on the recognition that you received. But
thank you.
But was it an aha moment? I mean, were you and Sean talking about something, and all of a sudden you saw dirt?
I think there was a lot going on when we were talking about the concepts. I mean, we had meetings for months. I mean, Sean, correct me if I'm wrong, I think we had talked about this restaurant for over a year.
Easily.
So, I wanted to, just working with Sean and seeing his passion about the farmers, and through my travels in Austria and Oregon and Washington State and Germany and, Europe and France and all that, the one thing that really, when I was in Austria, that really came to my mind about the concept of the wine list was that every winery I go to, they talk about their family, they talk about their history, and then the next thing comes next is their soil. So I thought, well, is this even possible? So I just took a Tom Stevenson wine book, and I went page by page, and I started to outline all the different soil types and to see how possible it could be. And then from there, I found out pretty quickly that there were 5 major areas that I could work with and make pretty much 5 mini wine lists.
So that's what you did?
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah, the interesting thing is, and it's, as a geologist and a geographer myself, it turns out that there are only certain kinds of soils which will support wine growing at all. There are large areas of the world's geology where vines won't flourish. Because the soil's not right.
So exactly. It won't change. The soil won't change when the climate changes.
No, the soil will change, but it will change so slowly. Mm-hmm. I mean, it changes.
Years.
I mean, rocks change over millennia. Soils might change in thousands of years, rather than millions of years, but they still change slowly compared to where we are now, and we really don't know enough about, nor do we have enough money to put into really fertilizing soil to make it suitable for growing grapes when traditionally it wouldn't be. That's really never been a part of the equation. It's always been that you tried to plant grapes, and if they flourished, you kept on. If they didn't, you went somewhere else.
Yeah.
Well, let me do this little game that I like to play, is that here we have this extraordinary chef, Sean, I love you, and we also have an extraordinary sommelier. How about if you throw out a dish that doesn't have to be on the menu now, but just describing the components of your dish that indicate the kind of style of food you get at Husk, and then follow that with Clint telling what he would pair with it.
Sure. We just finished writing the menu for this evening here at Husk, and I've got it sitting in front of me.
Okay.
One of the dishes that we love here features a couple things that make this restaurant very unique, and we have a beautiful wood-burning oven, and a lot of the food goes in there. And the beauty of just using wood, smoke, and fire to cook with is one that we really love here. We have a friend who digs clams for us. His name is Dave Belanger. They call him Clammer Dave. and he literally will walk in the door at 5 p.m. for dinner service and dump the clams off every day. So
we met Clammer Dave at Hank's.
He is the coolest guy.
He's fabulous.
His clams are as good as they get. And so what we do is we throw them in the wood burning oven in a little saute pan. And once they start to get hot, just in that oven, once they just get ready to pop open, we take some tomatoes that we preserved from the summer in mason jars, and we put them into the smoker, and we lightly smoke, play off that wood burning oven and get that smokiness going. And we throw some of those smoked tomatoes in the pan, and we also finish with some sausage made from Alan Benton in Madisonville, Tennessee.
Oh, wow.
Who takes this sausage, and it's an old Tennessee Smoky Mountains technique where they take these cloth sacks, and then they take pork, grind it up, add pork fat, add some sage and some crushed red pepper, nice spice, and then they smoke it for a week. And it's so tasty. And we brown it off. That goes into the pan. So you create a la minute this little smoked tomato and bitten sausage sort of ragu, a little bit of lemon juice, a little bit of hot sauce, and you just toss the clams with that and serve them with some wood-fired crispy bread on the side.
Oh, wow. go for that one. What are you going to serve with that one, Clint, I wonder?
Well, there's a couple, you know, different options. My first guess would definitely, I love pork and apples. I think it's such a classic pairing, and having that pork sausage, which, knowing Sean's M.O., he usually likes to add a little spice there. So am I correct in saying that, Sean?
Yeah, always.
Yeah, so I love Riesling, and to me, Riesling definitely has that Granny Smith apple thing going on, but I think the most important thing about pairing spicy food is you need lower alcohol, because to me, the higher the alcohol, the wine, the more you're going to get that perception of spiciness and vice versa. So the spicier a dish, the more you're going to taste that alcohol.
So you want something, and you want something with a crisp finish too, right?
Crisp. Good acidity, definitely to cut through that fat of the Benton, and also lower alcohol, but even a little bit of residual sugar too, play off the spicy, because how great is spicy and sweet together? So we do, which you may have met him during the Wine and Food Festival, Ernie Lohsen, who's in the process. He loves Charleston so much, he's looking at real estate. So he spends a lot of his time, obviously, in Germany.
Oh, yeah, we met him.
Crazy, crazy fun guy. But he does his label, Dr. Lohsen, which is in the Mosel region of Germany, and they do it's a red slate bottling.
Okay, now what's next up, Sean?
The next dish is one that's really exciting for us because it tells a story about the food culture in Charleston in the 19th century. And there was this old dish called brown oyster stew with Benny. And
with Benny's.
It was a dish that cooked throughout the late 1800s and up until about 1940-ish in Charleston. And it just sort of disappeared because nobody was growing the right variety of Benny anymore.
Which is sesame seeds, huh?
Yep, and at that time, sesame was become genetically engineered to produce more oil, which ruined its flavor.
Oh, is that what happened?
So you couldn't grind it into flour to make the right paste or get the right flavor for this old low country sort of African oyster stew. And for a long time, and we've only had Benny for the past year, the true variety. We grew it in our garden last year. Very big seed saving project, required a lot of work.
You grew it?
We grew it. It grows like okra. It's very, very cool.
I have not a clue what it looks like growing.
It grows like okra. You have to chop it down with a chainsaw, tie it up in a shed, allow it to dry. The pods open up. You catch it with a little piece of plastic underneath as you shake the dried stalk. Tons and tons of work. But now we have Benny, and now we can recreate this dish from the 1850s that, you know, tells a beautiful story about that time period in Charleston right before the Civil War. And it's very, very simple dish.
That's absolutely amazing. Now what are we going to put with that, Clint?
I think definitely playing off that oyster and oceanic kind of brininess screams Albarino to me.
Okay.
We have a particular Dofiero from Rias Baixas, or in the Galicia region. So a lot of these vineyards sit very close to the ocean, so you almost get a little bit of salinity. Definitely seashells in the soil there. And Albarino is very aromatic to me. It definitely has that floral component to it, and it retains a lot of acidity, too, to cut through that creaminess.
I love that. If it's a good Albarino, I love it.
Yeah, and Dofiero is fantastic.
Now, what about one more, Sean? I can only do one more course, otherwise I'll be so hungry I'll have to go eat dinner right now.
I'm getting hungry, too.
But you have all the food there, and you can cook it.
Yeah, exactly. I can't wait. We're doing a fun fish course tonight where we're getting this beautiful trout right outside Asheville, North Carolina, and we're just leaving the skin on, pulling the bones out, throwing it in the wood-burning oven. It's so hot in there that it crisps up the skin, taking some cabbage from the garden, braised it in butter, super fresh, just got picked. We took some field peas that we preserved from last year.
Wow.
We cooked those in a southern-style pot liquor, so you get that sort of sweet and sour sort of flavor. And then the dish comes together with what's called tomato gravy, and it's this sort of southern way to use preserved tomatoes. What you do is you brown a little bit of butter, then you throw cornmeal in and make a roux, and you stir that around, let it get nice and brown, and then you throw your chopped tomatoes in from your mason jar, and you just bring that up to a simmer, allow it to simmer for a minute, throw in a little splash of milk, and you get this really delicious tomato gravy.
Well, how come this is probably just not a good thing to say, but why is it that modern Southern cooking misses all the subtlety and nuance of this great stuff you're talking about now?
Well, one of the honest answer is for a long time we haven't had the proper ingredients because they weren't being grown. We weren't having the correct varieties of those plants. And now we're getting to a point where we have real cornmeal that tastes like something. We have real buttermilk that tastes the way it's supposed to, and people are producing bacon the way it's supposed to be produced. And so now we can be inspired by these historical documents from the 19th century and 18th century and recreate those dishes in their truest form. And we the ingredients weren't available. And,
that's
and
so
now,
exciting.
But that's why you're seeing so much attention on Southern cooking in the South, is this little boom where we've got this beautiful ingredients and finally in our hands. And we're just going crazy because we've wanted to replicate all this beautiful food for quite some time and haven't been able to.
Okay, how about that one, Clint?
Well, I think this is a great example of you don't necessarily need to put white wine with the protein. It's a fish course, so a lot of people's first inclination would be white wine. But actually, because of that rich tomato flavor of that dish, I think Pinot Noir all the way. And one producer in particular from Sonoma Coast, Ted Lemon with Literai, does this wonderful, Anderson Valley. He also has some Sonoma Coast wines as well. But as Pinot Noir ages, it does take on a little bit of a tomato character to it. And I think this Literai has got this sweet basil. It's got those green notes to go along with the cabbage as well. And his wine is the single vineyard Le Larme, 2007. 4 years in the bottle. And Ted Lemon is, if anybody says terroir doesn't exist in the new world, they need to talk to Ted Lemon.
Good. Okay. Well,
it's all very exciting. You know, something I wanted to say is the thing that most surprised me when I went to Husk, I don't know why I had this idea that it was going to be a very small, sort of modest restaurant. It's gorgeous. I mean, I couldn't believe it.
Yeah.
Well, because food is updated Southern food, so the house needs to be updated. It needs to feel bright and fresh.
Oh, it's gorgeous. And you can eat outside?
Yes. People are eating out there all day today.
Oh, I just,
it's beautiful.
It was just breathtaking. The whole thing was just breathtaking. And I wanted to ask, what was that wonderful bourbon again?
Pappy Van Winkle.
That's it, Pappy Van Winkle, the best stuff in the whole world.
Where is that made?
Talk about that special label, too, yeah?
It's made in Kentucky.
Kentucky.
Made in Frankfort, Kentucky.
Where else would it be made?
Yeah, it was originally made by Pappy Van Winkle at Stitzelwell Distilleries, and it was Old Fitzgerald in the 60s. And it was made with a special wheated recipe by Pappy himself.
Oh, so it's really Old Fitzgerald.
There are only a few bottles of that, few barrels of that left. In fact, there are only two barrels of it left. There were three. We bought one. So we bought
one of the
last remaining barrels.
Great. Well,
20 years old.
Well, Sean and Clint, thank you so much for joining us. You brightened our visit to Charleston when we were there. You brightened our program today. We can't wait to come back and sample Husk completely for ourselves.
Yes, yeah, always a pleasure hanging out with you guys.
Yeah. Thank you so much.
Thanks so much.
Thank you, Clint.
Okay, you guys have a good weekend, okay?
Yeah, and congrats on both of you. Huh?
Thank you very much. We appreciate it.
And we'll be right back after a short break.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
Good to our word. We're back, and we're going to move into another interview following similar or the same pattern, actually, of the chef doing his dishes and tastings and the sommelier doing his wine pairings and why. But it's at a totally different restaurant, but also one that we know very well and we love.
Of course it's a different restaurant, but it's curious. It's a restaurant that almost flies under the radar screen.
Hanks.
And yet it's so good. So
love Hanks.
Do yourself a favor. Be like the locals who pack Hanks to the doors every evening and go to Hank's Seafood right in the center of downtown Charleston. And here's Frank McMahon and Joey Ryan.
Boy, it's so nice having you here, Frank McMahon and Joey Ryan. It makes me remember the wonderful meal we had at your restaurant, Hank's, in Charleston, South Carolina. Frank, you are the executive chef there, and you're going to give us, for the listeners who have not caught your previous appearances on the menu, just a brief recap of what is Hank's about, its history, what your mission is at the restaurant.
Oh, my pleasure, Anne. It was good to have you guys back in the restaurant again for the second Hoot & Wine Fest. I believe that we got to know each other last year, and this year it's been a pleasure to meet you again. Well, the restaurant was the brainchild of Hank Holliday, and it was he wanted to recreate a Charleston classic seafood brasserie. It was fashioned after the old classic Henry's concept, which is now defunct, and he asked me to come on board and act as executive chef and open the restaurant. And we've been in business for 12 years now and been very successful.
Because it's so good.
Well, we cater to a lot of different tastes. I mean, the menu is very diverse. It's quite large, and it's hard to do that at the volume that we do it at and do it well. And I think what we've done over the 12 years is remained very consistent without changing our concept. We've still evolved and stayed with the trends, the local sustainability issues, the locavore movement. So what we haven't done is rested on our laurels, and we continue to push forward.
Now, it's such a lovely room, though.
It's a really comfortable room,
and you're comfortable with not changing that one bit, I'm guessing.
Oh, absolutely. I would never do anything with the decor or the facade of the restaurant. The place just works.
Yeah, and you know what else works? Your service. Those servers are just so right on. They just sort of stroll through and with one look know exactly what it is you need.
Yeah, it's understated but very attentive. I agree.
Right. Yeah. Good work.
Now, the thing that fascinated me, and I've never mentioned this to you before, but the thing that I noticed is that the chefs and the waiters all sort of line up outside the kitchen to bring out the dishes, and you were doing that with us, but also with other plates. I mean, it's quite unusual service method.
Yeah, well, actually, you know, I'm not directly behind the line. I kind of supervise the food as it goes out.
Okay, all right.
Almost in an expediter fashion, especially on the busier nights, we kind of all pitch in together and help run food and make sure that everything is executed correctly. We have the raw bar and the kitchen are separate from each other, so we've got two areas that we need to make sure that everything is running correctly.
Now, you've been keeping up with the times, as you said, but you also told us when we were visiting with you that you are planning a fairly major revision to the menu. Tell us a little bit about that.
Yeah, I think what we're going to do is we looked at our menu, and our concept is fantastic. That would never change, nor would the core items. But I think what we need to do is look at our menu and give it a update, refresh it somewhat. I think that the logo will remain the same, but potentially the layout will go into a one-page format and will read a little easier to the customer. But we've got almost 50 items on the menu, and I think if we streamline it and lay it out a little different, I think that will give it a new look. And we also intend on making subtle changes seasonally in conjunction with the locavore movement and the sustainability issues that we're facing with seafood.
Oh, yeah, you've major issues. By the way, I researched this sheep's head fish or whatever it was.
Yeah, this is the local sheep's head. That's an excellent fish.
Well, you know, John Rowley in Seattle, he got so excited about it because he said there are three varieties of it, and he had one that was just awful, so he wanted to know where I had this wonderful fish, so I told him. So it's a different variety.
Yeah, the unique thing about that is that a lot of these local fish are reef fish, and they feed on the crustaceans, and that flavor profile almost transfers over, and it lends itself really well to clean, delicate, sweet fish. It's not overpowering, and we get great feedback on it.
Well,
yeah,
we're going to talk some more about what it reminded us of when we get to that part of the menu. But
okay.
But next up, we're going to revisit a meal. What fun. I wish we were having sheep's head and the other things you chose for us this evening instead of the lemon sole that I'm going to fix. I've got a challenge to make my seafood half as good as yours. But we just turned ourselves over to Frank as to what we should eat. And he said, I'll just send out a few things, ha-ha, as if he wasn't planning it really carefully already. And so start us off with where we began.
Okay, we began with the local stone crab salad, a warm local stone crab salad. And these are harvested here locally. And it was very simple. It was just the stone crab plucked from the shell. And it was seasoned with a little salt and pepper, obviously, some fine herbs, a little bit of lemon zest, and then some warm butter and olive oil. And that was it. It was very simple, some crostini and a classic Mary Rose sauce.
It was just absolutely beautiful. And we're going to have Joey, sommelier Joey Ryan. Joey, now you are a very distinguished sommelier, right?
Yeah, I've had a lot of fun working in different places in the city, and especially with Frank at Hank's. Frank's got a very robust background working in several amazing restaurants. One of my favorites is Le Bernardin, a place that features the flavor of the particular fish that you serve as the centerpiece of the dish, not overwhelming that with any sauces to hide anything. You select the fish for the flavor that's inherent in the animal, and pairing the wines exactly to that fish and the accompaniments has been a pleasure working with Frank, and specifically with the local stone crab salad. We went with the Casa La Postal Chardonnay from Chile,
which was excellent.
I like to work with a lot of international wines. We have a lot of domestic wines on the list as well, but this particular wine comes from an area in Chile with granite soil, no malolactic fermentation, but it's aged in stainless steel and oak, so it has citrus notes and a lush mouthfeel that matches with that warm butter in the local lump.
And it's really crisp. It's not a woody California Chardonnay. It's an elegant, acidic French style.
Exactly.
Chablis almost.
Alternative to a lot of the wines that we have on the main part of the list.
Next dish was a surprise combination, as I recall.
Yes, it was. We paired a yellowfin tuna, which was raw. It was slivers of yellowfin tuna, and I paired that with the copa, which was a cured pork shoulder, Italian style, and very savory, not hot, always a savory flavor to that. And had quite a bit of salinity, which went paired really well with the tuna, which needs a lot of seasoning. And we kind of under-seasoned the tuna purposefully for that reason. And we paired it with a tomato chive vinaigrette, and we also had some toasted bread in there, almost like a panzanella salad.
Now, why did you get the idea of doing that? It's a combination. I thought I'd had tuna with just about everything.
Yeah, I mean, if you think, you know, the first time I remember eating tuna or seeing it, it had been cooked rare and had been cut in the center, and I said, that almost looks like meat. I looked at it from a distance, and I said, it looks like rare lamb. But when you actually taste the tuna, bluefin, yellowfin, it's got a meaty texture to it. It's got a full flavor, but not too strong, and I thought it would pair really well with the salinity of the Coba.
Now, you made that yourself, right?
The Coba.
I did. We tinker around. We're predominantly a seafood restaurant, obviously, but every once in a while, the guys get a little wild here to try something different. And meat is a good source, and we had some leftover pork shoulder meat that we decided to cure right before Christmas. It took about 5 weeks, and it came out really well.
So, Joey, had you ever seen that on a plate before?
You know, I've learned not to let myself be surprised with the things that Frank does.
So the answer...
Best beef tartare I've ever had in my life, and here we are running a seafood restaurant. It was fun to watch him make that Coba, and I think that it gave me a really fun opportunity to explore. Staying in South America, I went with a Cabernet Sauvignon from Mendoza in Argentina, the Nahuel. It matched perfectly with the Coba, the meaty texture there. But it's not a heavy, robust, full-bodied Cabernet. You know, coming from Mendoza, it doesn't have the lush, big, extracted flavors of a domestic cab from California. So it actually is a cab that's worthy of the tuna and matched perfectly with the Coba, in my opinion.
Okay. I thought so, too. I thought
it went really well. In fact, it was at this point that the idea of recording about Hanks in this way came to us, I think, because you made such a wonderful transition from a non-American-style white wine to a non-American-style red wine in the twinkling of an eye. And then the next course was a wonderful surprise.
Yeah, we actually featured that for opening night, and it's actually on our menu. It's a fried oyster with a sweet corn leek and green tomato vinaigrette accompanied with pickled okra. And it was a huge hit opening night. It had that crispy texture from the oysters, nice bit of pickling, and acidity from the okra and the vinaigrette as well, and that hot-cold acidity versus sweet and crunchy combination went over gangbusters at that event. I got a lot of really good feedback.
I want some of that right now.
let's just plug in a reminder here to make sure people can follow the conversation. The opening night Frank is referring to is the Salute to Local Chefs, which is the kickoff event
of the Charleston Food and Wine Festival.
So you may be sure that Frank would have come up with something new, and he did. But he also gave Joey quite a challenge, because oysters themselves are not the easiest pairing in the world. And then with all that pickle alongside of it as well, Joey, what did you decide to do here?
Well, this is another fun opportunity. You know, when I was first learning about food and wine pairings, the most interesting thing that I learned is the best pairing for champagne is fried chicken. You've got the texture of fried chicken skins and the effervescence and the texture of the champagne. So I kind of went off on a riff with that. We've got fried oysters in a nice, great textured dish with a lot of acidity. Instead of going with champagne, I went with a Spanish cava, the Conde Subirats. It's from the Pyrenees in northeast Spain. It's Masabeo, Periata, and Chardonnay grapes used. And it's got a nice lemon and kiwi finish with a little bit of minerality. So I think it worked well, giving you that texture both with the oysters and with the wine selection.
Great. And then a relatively obscure fish, I think, Frank, you would agree,
except
for Charlestonians, to finish off our dinner. Go ahead.
It was a sheep's head sautéed, and we accompanied that very simply with a mussel saffron lemon jus. There was no actual mussels in it. It's the essence of the mussel cooking liquor infused with saffron, then hinted with lemon, and a very slight touch of butter at the end. I think that sheep's head really well. If you remember what I spoke about earlier, that they're a crustacean eater, and that whole shellfish lemon flavor came through on and really helped to make that sheep's head stand out.
No, I mean, I know about sharks. I know about sharks eating other fish, and I guess salmon eat other fish, but I never heard of a fish before that could eat oysters, shell and all.
That was the, I might say, listeners, that I wish this were television occasionally, because they presented us with a copy of a picture of this fish, and it has like three rows of teeth at least, because it has to, of course, open the oyster shells to get the oysters.
No, it doesn't. No, I don't think it doesn't open them.
Sure, it does.
I thought they ate them shell and all.
Those teeth are used to crush the oyster, and once the oyster is crushed, the shell is crushed, the oyster comes out, and that's what they, and they typically spit those shells out, but they do have
human
molar-looking teeth.
Yeah, I was kind of jealous myself looking at those. I said, you must have had a great orthodontist, but they're average Irishman's teeth right there.
I think so.
Of course, I like my fantasy. I pictured them very genteelly opening the shells of the oysters.
But they don't have any hands to hold the knife.
Sure.
I mean, that would be really smart if they could manage to hold on to an oyster knife. but I don't think so. Now, we had a long discussion about what fish this reminded us of. Because although it's local to Charleston, in fact, Frank, you said you have a specialist who actually fishes the sheep's head for you because he knows where to find it.
They're hard to get.
That's actually Joey's friend, Alex.
That's Joey's friend, okay.
Sources that for us.
And they're hard to get because you can't use just one hook on the line. They're line caught, which is a very important thing, too.
They're very difficult to catch because they're feisty. They have that set of teeth that we just discussed, but most traditional fish hooks don't actually get in there and hook the fish. And the other thing is, they're only in a couple of select areas. They're a very prized fish, so a lot of people have exhausted the areas where they're typically found. So we basically make a call to Alan, our fisherman, and he comes back with fish, but he won't tell us where he gets them. He keeps his fishing hole secret. So.
Yeah.
We don't know where they're yet, exactly.
Well, what I was leading up to is that when we were in Australia in the early 70s, you could still get large, wild barramundi. From the Gulf of Carpentaria, which is a brackish rather than saline, similar to, I guess, the waters of the Cooper River or the Ashley River or wherever Alan gets them from.
Sure.
But unfortunately, the wild barramundi is pretty much fished out now, and
the farm
variety doesn't even taste the same. But this is what it reminded us of. So if those of you who can remember eating barramundi as we can, almost four decades ago,
don't say that makes me nervous.
This is the closest thing you're going to get to that, and absolutely delicious.
And great texture, just great texture.
So how do we finish up, Joey, with this one?
Well, yeah, with the sheep's head and the mussel saffron lemon juice, what I wanted to pair with, I was staying in Spain, leaving the northeast coast and heading toward the northwest corner of the country with one of my favorite white varietals, the Albarino by Paitan is the winemaker. It's a nice white wine. Legend has it's probably a clone of Riesling. The name Albarino means white wine from the Rhine. It's a very aromatic, flavorful peach and apricot on the palate. Because of where it is, you've got the Atlantic winds rushing in. Some of the vineyards in Rias Baixas, this corner of Spain, actually have salt air resting on the vine, so you get some of that minerality as well. And the apricot and peach were a nice foil to the lemon and the jus, so it was a fun dish to put together.
Now, the last dish was forced upon us. I must say, and Miss Ann didn't participate, but I guess you can't leave a fine restaurant like Hank's, a fine southern restaurant, without a southern treat for dessert. So pecan pie, one order of pecan pie was ordered up, and that's a challenging wine pairing. Now, Joey, you tried a sherry with that, I think.
Well, what we did was we did the Cercio Madeira from the rare
Madeira, that's right.
Madeira in the style that was drank in Charleston and Savannah back in the 1890s.
Wow. So you were recreating a little bit of history.
Exactly. Now, and I got to say, I do agree with you. It would have been nice to put a robust bourbon with that. And specifically, I would have gone with our Pappy Van Winkle, but we were unfortunately out. Our allocation had been exhausted. But I agree. The bourbon would have been nice with that pecan pie. In fact, a lot of we do in my mom's recipe, we put bourbon in our pecan pie. So it's a perfect pairing.
Oh, really?
No, we met later on in the festival, the following day, we met Julian, who's the owner of Rip Van Winkle.
Yeah, fantastic operation they have.
And we told him about the wine pairing suggestion. And I must say, he didn't seem all that interested. I think he can sell all the bourbon he can make.
So, that's true.
He wasn't too worried about it.
He wasn't offering any more to you guys.
I don't think so. I think apparently the only way you can make sure you have a constant supply is to be like Sean McCready and actually have a barrel at Rip Van Winkle that you can draw down whenever you feel like it.
Exactly.
Yeah, he took all the allocation for the festival, but we partook in that at the party on Friday night.
Well,
we appreciate that.
Well, there was still some left because we partook on Saturday at a reception at Sean's new restaurant, Husk.
And so, I loved it, and I don't even drink bourbon.
There you go. So it's a really,
I just thought it was great.
So anyway, it was a very special adventure to be with Frank and Joey at Hank's. Frank always call you Saint Joe?
He calls me a lot of things. You caught him on a good day.
Yeah, rarely.
Okay. Well, I think in return, you should probably call him Saint Francis.
That's fair enough, Saint Francis.
And so Saint Francis and Saint Joseph, thank you so much for joining us on the menu. And all I can say is we'll see you next year in Charleston.
See you next year. It was a pleasure. Thanks so much.
Thank you. I wish we were there right tonight.
And stay with us, because we'll be back after a short break.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
Well, here we are again, and you know, it turns out we really have a lot of good friends in Charleston, South Carolina.
No, we just
going there. Next stop is, I would call him larger than life in many ways.
I was just thinking of larger than life.
Yeah,
the good
Brett McKee.
The good news about his new venture, Roadside Kitchens, is that they're going to spring up all over the South and all over the country if he has anything to do with it.
And we want one here.
Yeah, yeah. So here's our old friend Brett McKee talking about his new concept and how he launches a new restaurant in record time.
Listeners, you want to have a good time. You want to learn a lot. You want to eat well. Let me tell you, you have to connect with Brett McKee. Brett, we followed you through a number of scenarios here, and this is probably the most fun one that you've done. And it's your concept of roadside. First of all, you come from a fine dining background, right?
Absolutely.
You come from Oak Steak House, and you're doing vegan dinners occasionally. Not all. It's like a total change around. What got you moving?
Well, I like this. I bought this building, and if you come to Charleston where this is, it is 5 miles from anywhere.
I didn't think there was going to be a restaurant.
It was a failed location for five failed locations, a little place in the middle of nowhere. I understand. I studied demographics, so I know what's around here. But again, we bought the property and the building, and we said, okay, I'm going to do this business. I said, all right, what do I want to do with it now that I have the location? So I thought about my childhood. I thought about the economy. And I said, I want to do a roadside kitchen. Now, to your regular Charlestonian, roadside might be my little country roadside that I grew up in. Almost like that movie Ratatouille. When you say roadside, he ate the ratatouille and he went back to that roadside little barn stand. So I sat by the pool one day in my leisurely time. And I have a tremendous cult-like following on the social network, whether it be Facebook, Twitter, fan pages, group pages, profile. And I sat there and I said, I want to do a roadside kitchen. But it's not the roadside you think. I grew up in ethnic neighborhoods in Brooklyn, all right? Everyone came through Ellis Island. So I thought about, okay, whether you're Irish, Norwegian, Italian, Jewish, German, Southern, Southwest, wherever you're from. I said, I'm going to do you a favor and you're going to do me a favor. I said, go back two generations and ask your grandparents on a Sunday afternoon, what did they have? Was it your grandmother, Babushka, in Ukraine that was making pierogies? Was it Nana who lived in the basement in a brownstone in Brooklyn? And I asked that question. I woke up the next morning, and I didn't think anything about it. I woke up the next morning, and there were 267 inspirational responses. Here's how I grew up. I said, here's my concept. This is what I'm going to do.
This is original. We interview people, as you know, constantly, chefs, restaurateurs. I don't know anybody else doing this.
Well, have you ever seen the movie Aviator? It's Howard Hughes.
Yeah,
that's
sure.
What I am. I'm like, it's the way of the future. It's the way of the future. It's the way of the future.
Okay.
So rather than, and again, I have always come from high-end restaurants. I understand we're in a little distressed economy. So I said, what better than to open up some of the best memories that I think people have in life? Come in the kitchen on a Sunday afternoon. When I grew up, again, my age, 50s, 60s, extended families got together every weekend. Aunts, uncles, cousins. We went from Brooklyn, moved out to Long Island, where the diversity of the family would grow. All right? Got together every weekend. And then as we grew up, maybe you got together with a smaller family group on the weekends. Then it evolved into just holidays. Now, in the way the world is today, you're lucky if you see your kids eating a microwave dinner and you're back to work and you have dual working families. And we're turning into fat America, which I won't even go into yet. But I said, so most of the great memories that everyone has, I think, revolve around food. My father passed away. And when I was writing his eulogy, I thought about how some of what I didn't like about my relationship with his was the foundation of my hard work ethic, my colorful language. And then I thought about, okay, how did I grow up? There's a movie, Sandlot, that has a bunch of little kids, all these ethnic diversities. So I think about the roadside kitchen. So if I had a buddy of mine, Robert Giannisi, all right, I'm eating dinner at his, I could be 8 or 9 years old and eating dinner at his mother's house. Well, the grandmother lived in the basement, and she's rolling gnocchis and making gravy and braising short ribs and making sauce. I said, okay, that got in my head. Never did I think that 45, 50 years later, that would be what I'm doing. If I ate at Michael Rosenbaum's house, and the grandmother's in the basement making matzo ball soup and making a brisket. I'm learning that. I worked at a German delicatessen. Hermann, who my family knew forever, making Wiener Schnitzel, Austrian style, with the fried egg and a lemon beurre blanc and a warm balsamic potato salad. I was fortunate enough to grow up in these ethnic neighborhoods. So then, as I'm having this epiphany about the roadside, I said, why not go into different cities or different locations and just come in here and say, forget about the pretentious restaurants that are high-end, and I like them. There's nothing wrong with them.
Yeah.
But I said, let me come in and do something that is $14 to $24, that's affordable, and what I'm going to do is I'm going to recreate a food memory and take you back in time when life didn't suck, okay? I'm going to be friendly to children. I'm going to understand and diversify my portfolio. So when I come in and I use the social network, I'll come into a city, and I might come in and ask four prominent people in the city, give me your family recipe. I'll come in with my blog guys. We'll go in your house. You'll teach me how your grandparents, great-grandparents did it. I'll blog it. Then you'll... So it's all about taking things viral. Then the community feels like they're a part of the creation of the restaurant. Every week I run a contest, and on my fan page I'll say, give me some inspiration this week. I got a little brain fart going on here. Mm-hmm. Give me some inspiration. And if by Wednesday, so I do that on Monday, by Wednesday I'll pick a winner out. And if you inspire the special for the week, you can come in here and we'll announce it through our Facebook fan page that you come in, you inspire the dish, you eat free dinner for four people. And then I know that they will tell their friends on Facebook who will tell their friends on Facebook. It's like, whether it's Cool Hand Luke or what I learned as a kid, if you need a leaf, shake a tree.
Yeah.
So I'm constantly shaking a tree. Come on, boss. I'm shaking a tree.
And you have two of these already. One here in Charleston.
I have one here. One in Charleston, one in Charlotte.
One in Charlotte.
Very successful.
It's sort of similar, though. You said only 40% of your menu travels, and the other 60% is locally inspired.
Yeah, there are some roadside kitchen staples that are just so good and so successful.
You want to name some of those?
We've got this, what do you have here, about a 24-ounce
cold-smoked
pork chop that is grilled with the macaroni and cheese and the collard greens, and that's a staple southern dish.
Right. So
there are pierogies that are on the menu that kind of stay staple during the winter. We change during the summer. The fried chicken with tasso gravy and all that are some staples. My mother's cheesecake recipe, which was the best ever. You know, she and I used to compete on whose was better. And when she passed away, I forgot the recipe.
Oh.
When cleaning up her house, I went and this is cool that if I could show you guys, if we had visual, I would show you. It was probably about 12 inches thick of generations and generations of handwritten recipes.
Uh-huh.
So I found her cheesecake recipe. So it's on the menus as Brett's mom's cheesecake. There's a chocolate cake that has traveled around and followed me around that people love. So what we do is, we'll come in and it's like the theme song to Cheers, when everybody knew your name. I collect information just so tirelessly so that as I grow, people say, Brett, how can you do this and expand? I teach my staff concept that we do, that in my absence, can my business be as successful in my absence as it is in my presence? But it's that information that we gather. So if I'm not here, my manager or my chef will know, hey, Peter, you sat at table 11 last time. You started off with a glass of white wine. I saw you had the grilled calamari. It's no longer on the menu. Would you like us to do that for you tonight? But it's collecting that information. It's just really actually caring about the customers. I understand that in this economy, to come out to dinner, especially in secondary cities, it's not like when I lived in New York, going out is a prelude to a Broadway show or a basketball mm-hmm. game or something,
right. Well,
or
it's
after
life.
The game. This is your night out. I know that you're getting a babysitter or bringing your kids in this environment. We've got 2.5 acres with this outside garden.
Yeah, how many people do you see
we'll
here?
Do, on a weekend night, we'll do 400 to 500 people out here.
Listeners, we're outside, and it's truly lovely. I mean, it's just a...
So wherever you are in the country now and you're cold and freezing, we're sitting out here about 75 degrees watching the garden grow. Here we have live music. Yeah, we've got the organic garden out here that customers like because they see every month. And when I do the vegan dinners especially, we use what's in the garden.
Yeah, why did you select vegan? Because there were a lot of vegans around here.
A lot of vegans. Several years ago, I had probably 35 pounds heavier. Come from my father was a 14-year heart transplant survivor.
Ah.
I had a couple of heart attacks myself. I figured, let me change this. I surround myself with a group of people that want nothing but to make me better. I do a lot of Pilates, yoga, and acupuncture. So I was introduced into this community of vegans that there is a need for it. So what I do is I show people and educate people now how vegan food can taste delicious.
Yeah, well, Mark Bittman is doing this now, too.
Yeah.
He had the same
situation. He lost 40-some pounds. He does vegan. He eats vegan up until 6 o'clock, and then he has moderate amount of animal protein.
Yeah. Well, what I think it is, I think it's the perception of vegan. Uh-huh. People think that it's, you know, it's freeze-dried, or it's got to be an Asian dish, or it has to be raw. What I did in my vegan dinners, I will give you what I consider a meat and potatoes version of vegan. That this is stuff that you don't even realize is in your refrigerator and in every restaurant. Now, you have to be mindful, and this is why with these dinners, most of the time, I come in here and do it myself. They have to trust you. They don't want cross-contamination. They want to know that you're cleaning that grill before you're grilling those portobello mushrooms. So it's having respect for them. And so when I started this, the three people that Pumpty Dumpty together again, I really care for them. So they asked me to do this meal. So I cooked it with nothing but love. And that's how, again, this community embraces me that, okay, we trust Brett. And I come up here on stage and I tell you how I prepared each course. I involve...
You said, you're just a natural social media person, a social every kind of person.
Right, and plus
back
I'm so good.
Back to this restaurant now. You did lay out a number, well, two numbers. One, you told me how long it takes you to put a restaurant together, which is an amazingly short period of time. And secondly, you told me how many restaurants you were planning on opening in a given time frame. First, how long does it take you to
When I go into a city, it probably takes me about 2 weeks of going in. Now, I'll have a lead person go in there. We'll find a location. I'll go in there, and we might even videotape the restaurant before I take it over. I use, again, the social media and different networking where you can see the transformation. I hire the staff, but I don't necessarily have to be there. There's another friend of mine that started a company called People Matter, where people have to apply online, and I can see they will vet you and tell me if it's a green light or red light. Through social media, I can see a photograph of you. I can understand. I can get a feel of what I'm doing, so it doesn't require as much time because of technology. I can mention, let's just say a hypothetical city. I'm going to go into Nashville this year. Someone will be on my profile, which is maxed out, but it'll be someone who has 37 years in this business. Someone will say, Brett, I know what you're doing. I used to work for you 25 years ago, or I used to eat at your restaurant. I have a friend of mine that would be a great manager. Boom, right there. I'll have someone that says, God, Brett, when I was 19 years old, I worked in one of your kitchens, and now I'm a chef and I'm looking to make a change, or here's a list of people. So because of how I use the social network, it's not as difficult. And then I go into the city, and I, you know, maybe we'll get an RV where we'll do roadside food outside of the location, and I'll sit, have a table out there and say, come on, guys, give me your ideas. Help me create this restaurant. And invite people to do that and let them know when we're going to be there. I hire a good manager, a good chef. I come in. I make them understand the theme song to Cheers. The Everyone Knows Your Name. I make them karaoke it to me so that they now have drank the Kool-Aid. They know the concept that I want. Now, is it always going to be better? And then once I have all these open, then I will make. All right, and I can announce on my fan pages and everything that I'm going to be in this location for these 3 days, so come see me. But also, my staff understands the concept of playing the fan page game, engaging with customers, making, you know, in every experience, you have to have the wow factor. So how did I wow you? Was it my hostess at the door that was so good and didn't make you wait for a table or juggle things that you say, wow, look at the attention to get that. The place looks like they're on an hour wait. And because I've been here, because they're conscious of that, they flip. Don't go by what's on paper. Take care of your customers. Was it the service you got that wowed you? Was it the food you got? Was it my manager or me? My daughter runs, you know, the door up here, so people, you know, are...
That was your daughter?
No, she'll be here later tonight. Oh, but, okay. You know, people have seen her grow up, so, you know, right now she's a wow factor that, oh, my God, your little girl is now 21 years old.
How does this translate into how long it takes you to open? How long does it take you?
4 weeks, and then I can pop
That's
out
amazing.
And running on their
Absolutely
own.
Absolutely amazing.
Now, I will have to follow back, but after that four-week time, I think they're ready to go. And then I'll come back every other week. So twice a month I can pop into locations for a day or two. We can sit on a computer and look at each other.
Yeah.
I have cameras. I have, you know, I'm like Big Brother. I have security cameras. I can sit while I'm driving up here. Well, no, I don't do this while I'm driving. You didn't hear that.
Nobody heard that.
But I can sit at my house and watch a restaurant. I can go down to St. Bart's and sit on the beach and see what's happening at my front door, see what's happening at my bar, and say, hey, pick your head up. Someone just walked in. You're not opening the door to say goodbye. So I can operate from a distance. Again, technology.
Now, how many do you... You did have a number. How many are you going to open in, was it 3 years?
I think this year we will try to open up five more, two in the south, and then we're going to break out of this region.
And go to Brooklyn.
And we're going to go to Brooklyn. The roadside store is going to take the Brooklyn boy back home. I think I just got lucky this week and found a great location in Bay Ridge, which is where I grew up. My parents met on 3rd Avenue, went to Fort Hamilton High School, so there's a place on 3rd Avenue just came up. Then we're thinking about Pittsburgh and Nashville this year. And the idea is to go into secondary cities that are economically sound, and we have people that can either search out locations or suggest a city to me. Then I'll fly in, and it's just a gut feeling that I have to get. Does the city have soul? Will it embrace this? Do I like the location? And then that's what we do. But the idea is to maybe do about 15 of these in several years, possibly take it public and see where it goes from there.
I mean, like in Brooklyn, what's going to be, do you have to research that or do you already know?
I already know. That's where I'm from.
Tell me what some of the dishes would be then.
Here's if you want to know what the dishes will be, buy the Brooklyn Cookbook. I have the old one, and that's what it's called. It's called the Brooklyn Cookbook.
Brooklyn's very different now.
So again, you'll have to understand, there will be in Bay Ridge, you still have a lot of Irish, Norwegian, and Italian. You've got some other diversities in there. But think about the demographics of who's going to come into that restaurant. And then ask. I don't know what it'd be. Someone might come in with a South American dish that says, God, that sounds jam up, man. I'm going to do that. But there are no limitations. If you give me an idea and I don't think you're ever going to come in the restaurant, well, I probably won't put that on the menu. All right?
Now, tell me this. You have seen so much. You've had such a diversity of experience. You must have a list of things that you will never have your restaurant be. Nothing will ever be in your restaurant like that. What are the things that you're going to absolutely avoid in this roadside kitchen?
Are these food items?
Anything you like.
Anything having to do with a restaurant, its operations.
What they'll never
food.
Be in my restaurants is rude behavior. I don't think I need anything, even in New York, I don't think I need anything past the $28 mark. So you're probably not going to see any torchon of foie gras or sous vide of Chateaubriand or, you know, maybe we use, offcuts of steak. And sometimes I'll have a steak on the menu and get one beef tenderloin. But I can offer it three ways. I can say, okay, here's an American way with mashed potatoes, asparagus, and it's grilled. Okay, like you might have had in your backyard, maybe throw a corn on the cob. Then I can take that same steak and do steak pizziola. And I can sear that with a little Tuscan rub, and I can put the peppers and onions and garlic and the white wine and marinara and steam it, and then slice that over the plain, and I have steak pizziola. I can take that same 8-ounce steak, cut it in two tornadoes. I can do steak au poivre with a little truffled palm frites. So I can take one piece and give you three different countries from it.
Now, last place. People can track, unless they're into social media, in which case they can track you that way, but there's a website
you
for
can
the
go
whole
to www.roadsidekitchens.com. There, that will take you to my homepage. You can follow the blog site on there that has a lot of good video on there. That will take you to the different fan pages, and there you can stalk me.
but watch out, listeners, because if you're interesting, he's going to be stalking right back.
Oh, I'll come find you, man. But again, hey, give me some inspiration. Tell me something that you had. You never know. I might show up at your door, knocking on the door with my camera crew and say, all right, I want to see your great-grandmother's recipe on how to do that.
Well, what a delight. Brett, we wish you all the success we know you're going to have. Thank you so much for joining us on the menu.
Thank you very much for coming in.
Good food.
And now a short break, but don't go away because we've got another great interview coming up.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
Okay, we're back and finishing out the program, Nico Romo, chef at a restaurant simply called Fish, who Spanish.
He's under the radar, too.
Yeah, he's under the radar, but he, I guess his ancestors are Spanish. He grew up in France, and now he's cooking seafood with an Eastern flair in Charleston, South Carolina, in an area of Charleston that's growing rapidly called North King Street. Here's Chef.
Well, I used to love to play that card game called Go Fish. Did you, Nico Romo, know this as a child in Lyon, France?
No, I never heard of that game.
Well, it wouldn't be quite the same thing in French, I'm sure. But anyhow, Nico, you are from Lyon, and you are French-trained, And you now work for Patrick Properties in Charleston, and we're talking to you from what you consider to be your home base restaurant, Fish.
That's great.
That's correct. Before we get into that, you have a very complicated background and a lot of different influences in your life. Your name, Nico Romo, is Spanish from your grandfather from Granada. And then your mother is Italian from southern Italy.
Mm-hmm.
And then was your father, your grandfather that was sent as a colonist to Algeria?
Well, when they leave in Spain, my grandmother was born in Spain, both of them, but they're not together yet. They actually met together in Benissaf, Algeria, because a lot of Hispanic people were moved as colonies to Algeria as a French colonies, and they actually met there in Benissaf and had my dad there.
Okay,
so,
and then when
my dad met my mom in Lyon, France. Okay. After they basically got kicked out of Algeria because of the independence. So
right.
they all moved back to Lyon because we had a grand uncle that was living there. So that was kind of like a 1.2. Actually moved back into a one bedroom house. And they all sleep together in one room, on the floor, because they lost everything.
So that's why you said, another of the reasons why you decided you wanted to do something where you could leave home really early?
Yeah. Well, no, my dad did pretty good, so I did have my own bed after a while. But no, it really, it's amazing what they went through to be able to get where they're at. My grandfather went to work for Renault Trucks, which my dad actually took over after that. And so he went in the factories. But, you know, for a fisherman that was owning his own boat, a captain, from that kind of life living, going back into a 9-to-5 job, working in the industry because you got to make your family a living. So that was a pretty big change for them. So, and my dad and my mom met because they were living in the same neighborhood in Lyon, and that's how they met.
Now, what is Patrick Properties?
Well, Patrick Properties a property company at first. When he started, they bought buildings that was in bad shape that will kind of go down to be ever destroyed. And most of the time was going to get destroyed and, you know, not be taken care of. And then as Charleston's been renovating, if you think about where we are right now, you can even walk in down that street without maybe getting shot.
Uh-huh.
So this old neighborhood here was awful. Now we call it the soul of Charleston because it's kind of like
right.
This new neighborhood just kind of come back up. And those pioneers of starting this was the Patricks. You know, they start putting money into places that nobody will ever want to touch. And they took over the feeder, renovated that, and took all the buildings that were next to it that actually were. The only thing is left in this restaurant was one wall that you can see right there.
See.
That's the last piece. That last brick wall was the one only part that's still original from this building, and then took the building next door too.
So they have 5 restaurants, according to my little card here.
Well, one restaurant is Fish. But Fish is the base restaurant. The rest of the buildings are basically location for weddings. So we do our special events. So we do wedding, catering, wedding, sweet 16. You know, the feeder is a great space for sweet 16 or 21's birthday or, you know, or whatever you want, rehearsal dinners, bachelor party, whatever you want to do. And the home, like the William Canals and Lounge Grove, those are historic homes from the 1800s. So in those type of building, we basically do all, like, weddings, a lot of weddings there. So, I mean, I do up to, like, 9 weddings in the weekend.
Wow.
We married a lot of people.
Now, you have a very special, do we call this not an award, an honor, a designation as a master chef of France.
Mm-hmm. It's called Maître Cuisinier de France, which is French master chef, yeah.
Right. And how do you get that?
Well, you get that by actually where you've been, and you got to have to be invited by a master chef to be invited to be part of it. And then you get revised by a board, and the board decide on that if you're the right person to be part of a group. And you take some tests, basically, and it's kind of like a bit take you and then put you in places and then you get selected and then you get to come in. And that happened to me 2 years ago, last year actually.
Was this the master chef that was your mentor in getting you to the United States anyhow?
Yeah, that was José. José Gutierrez was like kind of my father. He's the one who took me. my American father took me to bring me to America and then kind of take me in and help me, you know, move to jobs and like go to from Peter Hotel to go to Ritz Carlton. And
yeah, you were at the Peabody Hotel with the Ducks.
Mm-hmm, that's great. So, it's a fun hotel.
Yeah, so you were in Memphis, you were in Atlanta, and you were with the Ritz Carlton group, and now here you are in Charleston, and apparently you like it pretty much, huh?
Yeah, it's a good city. You know, it was a big change from a larger city like Atlanta, which is much bigger. It was kind of like, oh boy, and, you know, smaller city, smaller town. But kind of like, you know, when you get here at first, you're kind of a little bit like, oh my God, I don't know. And then you get to another city and you understand it's actually an incredible town. It's way more fun than it was in Atlanta. And
lots of history. And
like, yeah, and food-wise, for a chef, I think it's one of the best towns. Yeah. You get incredible ingredients, all local ingredients. You know, I put my hands on all fresh fish from boat, local clams, local shrimp, produce from farmers down the street.
You have a garden, you said?
Yeah, we have a garden at Lounge Grove on the plantation house. We have a little garden there. We can grow stuff for ourselves, grow our own herbs. We got a lady who grow our microgreens. We got farm eggs. You know, we do a lot of recycle and we do a lot of composting. Our compost actually goes to our pigs. Our pigs, we eat the food that we're composting from the restaurant, which is really cool. I think it's those kind of things that you can't really do in a big city, you know, and you can do that easily here and do it right.
So now you are a very modern chef in that regard. And so you're French trained with Italian, Spanish roots, not to mention North Africa, but you also, for some reason here, you have an affinity for Asian ingredients.
Yeah.
Now, how did you get that?
Well, I think the Asian food is kind of a discovery for me. It was kind of like when I came to America, I realized how much the Asian community influenced this country. I mean, I think it has a Chinatown. Every big city in the United States has a Chinatown. And then when you can't understand it, you don't know what it is going on there. And then you get into those stores and you see all those ingredients. You're like, what the hell is this?
So you start experimenting with, food also has an Asian influence to it.
All dishes. Yeah, I mean, I use classic French, and I play them with French with an Asian twist using local ingredients. I think it's so much fun because I think the Asian kind of bring us first for me is a discovery, something fun to play with, and two, I think also bring spice, heat. You know, French food is not known to be spicy, so it helps bring a little bit of spicy and also a little bit of sweetness. And I think, you know, to the American palates, if you think about, you know, people like sweet food. You know, French is not sweet. It's not sweet and salty. It's a lot more mild.
Like sweet food.
and I'm not a fan. I'm just saying, but I do think the Asian food bring a little more, break down a little bit of a sweetness.
Yes, I'm getting hissed at by my husband here.
You're not getting hissed at in the smallest possible way.
Right. And he's telling me that I should check out this menu. You know, I might say that I have in front of me the winter menu, and in 2 weeks' time, it's going to switch to spring, which is encouraging to think about. Not that the menu's going to change, but that we're going to hit spring. But looking at this menu, how would you characterize it? And can you pick a few dishes you would like to talk about and explain?
Yeah, like one of the main dishes, I think, is the bouillabaisse. It's probably the most popular dishes, but that's what really represents this.
Which one is that?
The bouillabaisse.
A bouillabaisse, okay.
A bouillabaisse is basically a classic French dish in south of France, which was made in Marseille. And it was made because it was a fisherman that made it. You know, it was just a fresh broth, water, fish inside, and we boiled it all up together.
Yeah, but you added coconut lemongrass broth.
Uh-huh. And it adds the Asian twist to it. And I give you the citrusy and the freshness in it. And it really is such a light dish. It's the most popular dish on our menu at this point. And then everyone eats, and you know, it's totally different vegetables in it, like the bok choy and stuff like that. It's a really fun dish with a lot of color and a lot of flavor and a lot of freshness. And the citrus with the seafood just goes so well.
Well, this one is fairly arresting. Your scallops, pan-seared with sweet potatoes, caramelized leeks, Napa cabbage, chestnut, port wine butter sauce. That sounds very elaborate.
Yes, and it's a good one too. I think it's one of a fun one right now for sure. That's one of the new dish we put on the menu this season. It's been one of the one who's moving the most actually. We do a lot of same thing. It's kind of like it's whole vegetables, and actually we twist the whole vegetable mix is actually twist over a little bit of a cheese sauce, and we tie it all together. Uh-huh. It's really wintery, you know. It's kind of give you that cabbage, you know, that bacon, chestnuts, sweet potatoes, just the right time of the year.
Yeah, well, I mean, there's so many interesting things here. I don't know how we're going to select what we're going to.
But I think the dim sum is one of the things is fun. I think the dim sum is what actually helps us a lot with making people try new things. For me, it's a great tool because you get four pieces. It's basically 4 little smaller piece of appetizers that you get for one price. And then when you get those 4 pieces, you get to choose a couple different ones. And for example, I have one of them is the frog legs.
I've never seen frog legs dim sum ever.
Well, yeah, that's what we do, something different, you know. So the frog legs is like, the idea and the concept of the frog legs behind it is, you know, people don't eat frog legs. Let's be honest. In America, I don't think it's one of the main dishes that if I would be sauteing frog legs with bones in on my menu, it's probably one of the dishes I probably move or less. So it's a way to play with it. We take the frog legs, we debone them completely. We batter saute them with fresh ginger. Oh my God. Breadcrumbs, Japanese breadcrumbs, a little bit of sriracha,
panko,
a little bit of sriracha, a little bit of lime juice. Yeah, a little bit of sriracha.
A little spicy there.
Exactly. And we mix it all up together and we cook it down. And then I do gougères. Everybody knows gougères. Gougères is a great little thing. And we use the little gougères and we stuff those frog legs in it. And what we do is we bake it all right in. So it's basically a stuffed gougère with frog legs in it, and we put a little fondue cheese sauce right on top of it. And that's it. It's a one bite. And people love them. I mean, they think, it's a really fun dish.
Well, listeners, it's a very fun menu. It's all the stuff that you're really not expecting at all, such as steamed clams with capers, kefir lime broth, shallots, and cilantro. What do we have here? We have tuna tartare with cucumber, peppers, shallots, chive, crème fraîche, and Vietnamese crackers, or Vietnamese pork satay. I mean, it's just all over the place, and it looks very interesting and exciting.
Yeah, and the pork satay is good. We're using a local goat cheese yogurt, and we make a sauce out of that with a cilantro puree in it, which is a really fun thing.
You even have goat cheese spring rolls.
Yeah.
Oh, dear. Well, Nico, it's wonderful being able to talk to you. Thank you for
thank you.
talking to us, and also we look forward to sampling your food.
I had actually one last question.
I think
it must be an interesting time to be a chef in Charleston because there are so many young chefs doing new and different things. Do you find the local chef community is one that you enjoy being a part of?
Yeah, I mean, I think we have one of the top local chef community ever. I mean, the number of chefs and the quality of food you can get here is incredible. You see Cypress charcuterie, you know, Craig Deal. I mean, his charcuteries are incredible. Now you see Sean Brock doing his own pickling and his own vegetables.
Raises his own
garden.
Pigs.
Yeah, and then he's really taking this far with it. And you got McLada, who's just doing an incredible job of just maintaining a quite Ukrainian and being true to the food. I think he's a great chef.
Who's that you just talked about?
Mike Latta.
Oh, yeah, Mike. We love
him.
Mike.
Yeah, Mike's food really simple, really fresh, really done well. I think he's one of the top chefs also. But the community is that way. But I think the difference, I will say, between me and them is I'm definitely not – he has no southern cooking. You know, I don't have collard greens. I use local ingredients, but I don't use – there's no shrimp and grits. There's no southern cooking here. It's really something different in Charleston that you don't have. I mean, a French and Asian fusion restaurant, you don't see that anywhere here. And so I have definitely a different edge in what I'm doing, but still in the same philosophy of using the local ingredient, using fun food, which is great.
Well, we're looking forward to it. So there you have it. It was a long program, but I'm sure you think it was worth it, and we enjoyed our visit, and you'll enjoy visiting all these fine places next time you're in Charleston. In fact, make a special trip. And now, until next week,
bye-bye.